It's been a few weeks ago that we started this short series of lessons. We started in Ezekiel chapter 9. God is getting ready to destroy Israel, actually Judah. The temple is about to be forsaken. Six men come with battle axes, and God tells them to go throughout the city and kill everyone. Another man appears before him with an inkhorn and a stamp. God tells him to put a seal or put a stamp on the foreheads of all who sigh and cry over the abominations that are being done. And then I pose the question, would we get that stamp? Do we sigh and cry over all of the things that God identifies as an abomination? We then looked at the topic of fornication and how fornication in all of its forms is an abomination before God. Homosexuality, adultery, bestiality, fornication, sexual activity between teenagers, unmarried people in any way, shape, matter, or form, it's an abomination. It's disgusting to God. It is a sin against one's own body. Last week we discussed the difficulty of living in America and assessing whether we have an issue with money or not. We made the point that if you do what the Lord commands you to do, which is to be a loyal, hardworking employee, most people can rise to the point where they do get a good salary. And they are well paid, and many people, without even trying, become very wealthy. And Paul did say, charge those who are rich not to be high-minded, but he never said they needed to sell what they had. However, there's a line, a very fine line, that people living in a culture like ours often can't see. And so in our lesson last week, we discussed how you can try to understand or figure out where you are with money. I want to talk a little bit more about money because whether you're aware of it or not, Jesus says the love for money is an abomination. And so do we sigh and cry over all of the elements of love for money? Now, in this passage in 1 Timothy 6, the Holy Spirit reveals that even a desire to be rich, you don't even have to be rich, you just have to look at other people and want to be rich. The desire to be rich leads to temptations and snares and many foolish and harmful lusts. Look at Balaam, Ananias and Sapphira, Judas. Desiring money led them into terrible, terrible circumstances. Things you would have never dreamed. How could an apostle allow his greed and his money to lead him to such an end? How can a prophet like Balaam be swayed by a love for money and power to give Balak the advice to get his beautiful women to tempt Israel into idolatry? Many foolish and harmful lusts which drown men in destruction and perdition. And again, I think Balaam and Judas are a classic example of what can happen. Where did that start? Judas started, like all of us, as a little boy, a good boy, without any real proclivities or problems. But something happened. Balaam lived many years as a faithful prophet to God. But something happened. Did it happen then? Did it happen before then? These are important questions because there is no question that loving money is a grave danger, a serious sin, and the source of many other lusts. Murder often is committed out of a love for money. Many of the sins, kidnapping, many of the terrible things that man has devised and developed are the result of a love for money. If loving money is an abomination to us, we avoid all of this. The desire to be rich, the love of money. Verse 10, the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil. It's not the root of all evil, as some people quote, but it is a root of all kinds of evil. Now, that leaves it in the category of an abomination. And so, ambition and the desire to be the best in our field versus the desire to become rich is often a very, very fine line that we need to be very careful about. Many of the television programs that entertain the people of our culture are based on a love for money. Is that an abomination to us? Some have strayed from the faith in their greediness, piercing themselves through with many sorrows. Loving money is dangerous, but it's also an abomination. No servant can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or else he will be loyal to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon. Now the Pharisees, who were lovers of money, there's that word, there were lovers of money, heard all these things and scoffed, derided, and looked down upon him. Jesus said to them, "You are those who justify yourselves before men, but God knows your hearts, for what is highly esteemed among men is an abomination in the eyes of God." Now look at verse 13 there. No servant can serve two masters. If you love money, you can't serve God. That's why it's an abomination. If you have a desire for money that will cause you to compromise. How many times have people who told their employer they would never work on the Lord's Day been tempted by double time or triple time or some other amount of money to place money above their service to God? No servant can serve two masters. Brethren, it is incredibly important that we assess our attitude toward money in a prosperous nation where we don't have to work hard to get money. And the love of money can insidiously, quietly grow within us as we make choices until we start making wrong choices. We decide to get a car, so we have to cut back. Ultimately, we weren't planning on that, but we got something too expensive. Now we have to cut back our giving. That's a bad step in the wrong direction. God must come first. The Pharisees were lovers of money. This made no sense at all to them. What do you mean you can't serve God and money? We're doing it. And Jesus said, "You are those who justify yourselves before men. But God knows your hearts. God knows what is highly esteemed among you. And it's an abomination to him." So, who are we more closely aligned with? Again, as you're watching a movie where evil is done as a result of loving money. A murder. Are we disgusted with the murder or with the love of money that caused the murder? Does the love of money even register in our mind as a sin in and of itself and a grave danger for us to be aware of? Two different translations put it, I think, in a pretty clear way. The first one says, "Beware and be on your guard against every form of greed." Every form of greed. There's forms. It's like the rainbow. There are colors in the rainbow. There are forms of greed. And some of them are very difficult to see. Not even when one has an abundance does his life consist of his possessions. The second translation, "Take heed and keep yourselves from all covetousness, for a man's life consisteth not in abundance of the things which he possesses." You remember the parable, the man who had enough to take his ease, but decided to build bigger barns instead of taking that time and opportunity to be of service to God. He continued to serve money. Attitudes toward money are very dangerous, and we need to make an assessment. Now, the rest of this lesson is going to be designed to help us make that assessment. But I just want to make us aware that a lot of people don't see a love of money in and of itself as a problem. They don't see it as a sin. They don't see it as an abomination, but it is. Look at the company it keeps. This you know, no fornicator, unclean person, nor covetous man who is an idolater has any inheritance in the kingdom of Christ and God. The line between love of money and covetousness, there's a fine line there. I won't say that they're identical, but they're close enough that I think we can make some parallels. The covetous man is an idolater because no one can serve two masters. He will either hold to one or the other. If you hold to money, you're an idolater. If you hold to God, you worship God. Unclean person, fornicator, covetous man, all in the same list. Let no one deceive you with empty words, for because of these things, the wrath of God comes upon the sons of disobedience. Therefore, do not be partakers with them. But how do we know? We live in America. We live in an upward mobile society. We live in a society where the advertisers are continually trying to tempt us to want more. Things are obsolete almost before we buy them. And so, do not be partakers of them. Maybe a little more complicated. Maybe we really haven't thought through what this verse is telling us. Now, I'm not saying we have or haven't. No one here, and I've never had a conversation with anyone here. I've really never had a conversation with anyone where I came away saying, that person has love for money. But somebody has to. It has to be a problem. Jesus talks about the fact that the desire for riches chokes the word. I mean, he makes the three basic reasons why people don't become a Christian or stay faithful. One is a hard heart. The second is persecution and tribulation. And the third is the cares of the world, the desires for other things, and the desire for riches. Somebody has to have it. Jesus said it's one of the main reasons why people don't remain faithful. So, are we missing something? Are we clear on this? Do these words resonate, or do they confuse us? Do they leave us with, I don't know where he's going. I don't understand. How could there be a problem? We live in America, and this is all normal. Well, it might be normal. It might not be normal. In a culture where fornication is normal, in a culture where homosexuality is becoming normal, in a culture where adultery and divorce for any reason is becoming normal, how do we know whether our attitudes toward money are normal? What is normal? The things that are highly esteemed among men are an abomination with God. We're going to have to delve into the scriptures. Where's this elusive line between the classic American lifestyle, keeping a car for so long, selling that car, buying a better car. Some people buy a new car every year. I don't think I've ever met a Christian who does that, but some people do that. Nicer homes, buying another home, second home somewhere else. Where's the line? Everybody thinks that's okay, but at what point does God say, where am I in? Your giving is staying abysmally low while you buy and buy and buy for yourself, and you turn around and tell me that you don't have a love for money. And you turn around and tell me my zeal for you and my love and devotion for you are fixed. And then we look at the amount we give. Where's that elusive line? One of the Ten Commandments. You shall not covet your neighbor's house. or your wife, or manservant, or maidservant, or ox, or donkey, or anything that is your neighbor's. You say, well, where's the love of money in that? Well, unfortunately, the motivation behind a lot of that covetousness has to do with a desire for something you don't have, or something better that you don't have. And that's what always starts it off. You're a little boy, you're a little girl, you're looking at people. Some people live much higher than you do. Some people have much more than you do. And you make a decision. I want to be like that. Subtle changes start to come into your lifestyle. You start deciding to, or make decisions based on, where will this end me up? I want a career where I can make money. I don't want a career that is useful for people. I don't want a career that makes me happy. I want a career that will make me money. That's a valid question. Why are we doing what we do? And then sit down at the end of the month and just look at, where did your expenditures go? Here's how much you gave to the Lord. Here's how much you gave to the needs of brethren and the needs that are all over. And here's how much you spent on disposable income, we call it. The word covet means to take pleasure in, to delight in a thing. What's wrong with that? What's wrong with delighting in a new car? What's wrong in delighting over something your neighbor has? Selfishness, idolatry, serving God or riches, which is really what the word mammon is referring to. We've got to delve into this. We've got to put on our Sherlock Holmes hat, and we've got to try to work out our own salvation and make sure that we're not a part of this. Now, the New Testament counterpart is one eager to have more, especially what belongs to others, greedy of gain, covetous. Now, we talked last week about how we can identify this in somebody like Scrooge. We can identify this in somebody like Midas. We can identify this in somebody like Balaam, or somebody like Judas, or somebody like Ananias and Sapphira. But where is the infancy? Where does it start? That's what matters. That's where we have to focus, because that's where it's going to hurt us. Because the moment of starting, like Jesus said, if you look at a woman to lust, you're there. You don't have to go any further. It's in its infancy. But it's a sin. The same thing with covetousness. It may never even come out. You may never even get there. You may never get anything. Some people covet and don't receive. Didn't James say something like that in chapter 4? He that was sown among the thorns, this is he that heareth the word, and the care of the world, the deceitfulness of riches, choke the word, and he become unfruitful. Here is a meaningful scale or balance. Here's the responsibilities and obligations that I shouldered when I became a Christian. Here are the obligations and responsibilities of wanting to become rich. Which one got bigger? Which one got smaller? Are we more zealous? Are we more intent? Are we spending less and less of our money on ourselves, more and more on the Lord, His work, His kingdom, His people? Or are we becoming unfruitful? In Luke, he says this, that which fell among the thorns, these are they who have heard, and as they go on their way, they are choked with cares and riches and pleasures of this life, and bring no fruit to maturity, no fruit to perfection. So as we think about this, I mean, this is a tough question, because it hits at the heart of one of the things that man really enjoys, and that is his possessions. And yet Paul says we should learn how to be content with food and clothing. There's a disconnect somewhere there. Now, we may be navigating it fine, and I'm certainly not preaching this lesson, because I think we're not, but this is something we all need to take a good look at and a good, honest assessment of our values and what's important for us. Here's a clear antidote, and we can make this assessment. It's very easy. Charge those who are rich in this present world. Now, most of us like to think, this verse doesn't really apply to me. This applies to the billionaires, the millionaires. But if you've ever been to a third world country, you understand that there's not a single person in America who's not rich in comparison to the poverty of other people. They be not high-minded. One of the complaints when you get out of America is that Americans are very arrogant. They think they're the best on the earth. No one's ever been like us. That resonate with you? Do you feel like that? Feel like we're really something to be in America? Don't be high-minded. Money doesn't make us important. Money doesn't really do anything except give a greater responsibility. To whom much is given, much is expected. And they ask the more. The more money you have, actually, the more responsibilities and obligations you have. It's not simply a matter of possessions. It's a matter of stewardship and responsibility. So charge those who are rich that they be not high-minded, nor have their hope set on the uncertainty of riches. Retirement income is dangerous because it makes us think, or could make us think, we don't need God. We don't need our daily bread. It's set up. I'm set up for the rest of my life. No, you're not. Don't be high-minded. Don't think that riches are going to give us anything. On God, who gives us all richly all things to enjoy, that they do good, that they be rich in good works. A good work is time, money, and effort to help people who are in need. And sometimes we're so busy with our toys, so busy with our hobbies, so busy with our enjoyments and the little things we still need to buy to make it even better, that we lose sight of the other side. And we don't want to stand before God on the judgment day having tipped too far into this abomination. We need to do good. We need to be rich in good works. We need to be ready to distribute or share and willing to communicate, which means to pass it on to other people. The Good Samaritan was good because he gave his time, his comfort, and his money to the need of someone he didn't even know. And Jesus commended him. The Levite and the priest, don't know if it was love of money, it may just have been lack of compassion, but the point is simple. When we have opportunities and we have abilities, verse 19, we have to lay up in store for ourselves a good foundation against the time to come, that they may lay hold on life, which is life indeed. I didn't put the verse in here, but Jesus does say in one place, make use of unrighteous mammon so that when it fails or you fail, you'll be received into eternal tabernacles. We only have. He said, if you can't be faithful with unrighteous mammon, who's going to give you the true riches? Who's going to put you in, give you, is God going to give you the opportunity to preach to the Ethiopian eunuch? Is God going to give you the opportunity to go to Saul of Tarsus when you can't even use your money? You can't even use unrighteous mammon. Who's going to give you the true riches? So, these are the questions. Are we high-minded? Are we counting on it? I'm going to live to retirement and I'm going to enjoy my retirement. Sounds kind of like that guy in Luke who was going to build bigger barns. What if your soul is required of you today? What's going to happen to all of that? Is it really that important that we are sacrificing our good works and alms deeds that we could do today in order to enjoy a part of our life that we may never even reach. High-minded, hope-set, doing good, rich in good works, ready to distribute. These are uncomfortable questions, but they need to be asked before we stand before God. Behold, this was the iniquity of your sister Sodom. Pride, fullness of bread, and prosperous ease was in her and her daughters. Neither did she strengthen the hand of the poor and needy, and they were haughty. You see how many things he lists before he gets to the abomination of homosexuality and the abomination of the sexual proclivities that those people had? Before they committed abomination, they had pride, fullness of bread, prosperous ease, didn't strengthen the hand of the poor and the needy. That's where we need to focus, because we have a nation that is very similar to Sodom and becoming closer and closer, seemingly with each passing day. Pride, fullness of bread, prosperous ease, didn't strengthen the hand of the poor and the needy. So, are these the sins of America, or maybe more importantly, are these our sins? Do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth. How can we not? If we work, we get Social Security. We're laying up treasures on earth. If we have a 501k and we're contributing to it. We could just go on and on and on. Lay not up for yourselves treasures on earth, where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal. But lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven. Make use of unrighteous mammon, so that when it fails, or you fail, they'll receive you into eternal tabernacles. We have, of all people, this is important for us, that we have laid up treasures in heaven. As you look at your monthly giving or weekly giving over the last 5 years, 10 years, does it in any way, shape, or form measure up to your 501k? Does it in any way, shape, measure, and form match up with the disposable income we're using for our own pleasures and our own hobbies? The love of money can insidiously start. Most of us keep it at bay. But that's where it starts. Chokes the word. So Jesus offers the perfect balance upon which to weigh motives, desires, priorities. With these scriptures, we're prepared to assess our hearts, our character, our attitudes, and the fruits. The lamp of the body is the eye. If your eye is good, your whole body will be full of light. Now remember, the context here is this love of money. The context here is dealing with laying up treasures on earth. This is right after lay not up treasures on earth. Because if your eye is good and you understand this and you're not serving mammon, your whole body will be full of light. But if your eye is bad, if you can't quite see clearly anymore, your body is going to get darker and darker. And then one of the most frightening things he says is, if therefore the light that is in you, that which is highly esteemed among men, which is an abomination before God, if what you consider to be the light is darkness, how great is that darkness? No one can serve two masters. Either he will hate the one and love the other, or else he will be loyal to one and despise the other. It almost sounds like he's preaching to this same group of people who scoff at him, laying up treasures in heaven, not letting the light become darkness, not serving two masters. We've already mentioned these people, so I don't have to say too much more about it, but These are beacons. Beacons of danger. Warning signs. If it can happen to Balaam, I feel so sorry for Balaam because he seemed like a very godly man. The first time he goes to God and says, Lord, these people have come. God says, tell them you can't go. He doesn't go. But then there's more money offered. More noble people involved. And so God told him, well, if you can go with them, but you can only say what I tell you. But in the morning, when the angel of Jehovah is ready to kill him, it's clear he changed sides. He was now an adversary. He went to bed, maybe. I don't know how this happened. But he, before they came, he was still right with God. But now he's an adversary who needs to be destroyed. And when we see the outcome, we can see why that was the case. Because that's ultimately what he became. He became an adversary who was destroyed. But I still feel sorry for him because that love of money drowned him in destruction and perdition. I've seen preachers, you've seen preachers that have also been drowned. It's a grievous thing. And it's something that all of us need to be aware of. So as we consider our final considerations, how do we give? 10%, 15%, 20%? What's our giving? I consider 10 to be a threshold. I think we should be giving above 10 because the Jews gave 10 and we have greater blessings than they do. How do we allocate our time as far as work, family, and God? Do we take a lot of overtime? Do we spend a lot of time on our job that doesn't need to be there but because we want more? How do we see our money? It's not our money. It's the Lord's money that he's letting us use. I gave you the power to be rich. And regardless of how rich you become, it can be gone tomorrow. And if you didn't lay up treasures in heaven, it's all gone. What are we purchasing? How do we see gambling? Gambling is pure, unadulterated covetousness. The desire to get something for nothing. Is it an enjoyable recreational activity now? Used to be vice. The vice squad of the 1950s would arrest people for gambling. It was seen as it should be seen, as an abomination, along with drug addiction, homosexuality, and prostitution. That's what the vice squad was for. Boy, have we moved. Used to be vice. Do we still see it as vice? Is it still an abomination, or have we crept? Have we moved? Is the light in us now darkness? So as we take all this information, what are we going to do with it? Going to forget it? We're going to go home and maybe look at our checkbook, look at our expenditures, consider our views, consider our priorities. Is the Lord still first? Are we still seeking first his kingdom and his righteousness? Are we still making sacrifices for the Lord, his people, and the needs of others, rich in good works, willing to share, willing to communicate, ready to distribute? These are hard questions of a people who live in prosperity through no fault of their own. I mean, it's not my fault that because we work hard, we can become wealthy. What's my fault is how I use it. And that's what we'll all be judged by. And so, brethren, as we pick up the song of encouragement this morning and we give careful consideration to what we've heard, if there's anyone in the audience who recognizes, I have a problem. I need to fix this. But I don't need to go forward. Make a mental note. I'm going to go home. I'm going to make some changes. I'm going to repent. I'm going to confess. And I'm going to change. But if you're here this morning and something in your life is troubling you, or it's time, you know you need to be baptized, today is the day you need to obey the gospel. If there's anything we can do to help you in any way, we invite you to come while we now together stand and sing.